when you consider that we had a campaign which was designed to enforce our Irish sovereignty over the whole island of Ireland, and now we now have an Irish Prime Minister who sees it as his objective, quite correctly, to win back Irish sovereignty now lost. That's a fundamental, how far we are from today from what it was all supposed to have been about for 30 years. And you really need to get reality to realise that, how profoundly changed the reality is. And one of the most profoundly crucial aspects of this change in reality, which we're only at the beginning of, is the relationship between Ireland and Britain, which is really fundamental. I personally do not believe quite as much as it's commonplace in Westminster, believe in the world-changing capacities of the Queen's visit, etc., etc. I do believe that there are fundamental changes in Ireland's relationship with Europe. I do believe that the part of the reason why Ireland is facing this crisis is paying a price for Anglophobia determining some of its economic choices in the past. And I do believe that fundamental issues are going to come up now about the relationships both economically and politically between Ireland and Britain. It is most unlikely that things will remain as they have done for over the past several years. We're at the beginning of a moment of change in the relationship between Dublin and London, which where it will go, I don't know. And one of the problems is that Dublin no longer has the attention of London the way that it once did. On the question of austerity, very simply, what I've just said about Ireland helps make the point. I mean, the United Kingdom government, whether it would be Labour or Conservatives, is determined not to end up in the same place, which means, and no government would be, there would not actually be a vast amount of difference. Everybody listens to the Labour front bench seriously in terms of the policies or their implications for Northern Ireland. No government, well, the changes that are envisaged in terms of public expenditure will be roughly the same, who's ever in power. And it's a fundamental issue. It's not done out of bad will. Governments actually like to spend money. It's easier to vote, it's an easier life. And Cameron almost certainly didn't see the economic crisis coming any more than anybody else did. And now finds himself in this position. But they are determined not to lose, and therefore and there will be difficulties in Northern Ireland as a consequence of this. But they are absolutely unavoidable. And that's why it's probably a good thing, and I tend to agree with both of you, that actually austerity as such, while a serious problem and destabilising in certain respects, is not the heart of the matter in terms of the peace process and its continuation. The truth of the matter is that troubles emerged after a period of in the 60s where Northern Ireland had a very, very low unemployment rate in the mid-60s, although what there was of unemployment was distributed unequally on Catholics, and that is also part of the reason. This is why these economic and social dimensions are important, part of the reason why once the campaign breaks out, once a political crisis emerges, there is a strong section of the Catholic working class with no ties to the existing system and are willing enough recruits for the provisional movement, although it required certain political triggers for that situation to express itself. So you can't say that economics are not important in this matter or potentially destabilising, and Katie's quite right about this, but fundamentally the initial triggers moving out of a period of relative prosperity in the mid-60s were actually political triggers. So we have this imperfect process. Peter's quite right, 108 MLAs were elected in the second last assembly election, who were totally committed to the existing structures, and this time it's 107 out of 108. You can't get much, you know, the stability of this thing is at the level of the elected representatives of the people is actually rock solid. The biggest problem that unionism has is really no longer its relationship with nationalists and with Dublin, as exemplified by Peter Robinson's speech in Ivy House in the ease of it last night. Long time it was a problem how to handle these relationships, but it just isn't the problem. The biggest problem that unionists have is their relationship with the United Kingdom and the still obvious inability to project. I would say that the parliamentary performance, because the distractions of the peace processes are much less than the last general election, has actually improved in the presence of union. Up to that point, people often were heavily involved in both things and so on and so forth, and for that reason, if for no other, and I don't think it's the only recently, actual presence of Unionist MPs was, let's say, not very striking at Westminster. But the biggest problem they actually have is projection in the United Kingdom. It's not actually projection in Dublin or projection in terms of relationship with nationalists. And the biggest problem that nationalists have, and I respect enormously everything, there is a tradition of democratic nationalism facing up to the principle of consent. And the SDLP has been a very important part of that tradition. But the biggest problem it remains, as it has been since Parnell and John Redmond, which is once you face up to that, to provide a language which actually contains any real elements of genuine appeal to unionists. And both those problems remain at this particular moment. And it's quite possible that for those reasons that this relative golden age from one point of view or another might be seen 10 or 15 years from now to have diluted, disappeared and dissipated. Because I want to end on the point that Malachy made. Malachy and I are both of an age where we remember this year, those 2 years, 68, 69. Both of us are around, there are other people in the room around the time. None of us, from the perspective of 1966 anyway, thought this was going to happen. So we've been wrong once, and it's afflicted our entire adult life. And I think
very jaundiced, you know.
I'm not sure. It doesn't feel to me that it can happen again, but it didn't feel to me that it was going to happen in the late 60s either. So you should, I think both Malachy and I feel you should take what we say with a pinch of salt. Thank you.
All right, we have about 20 minutes for questions. I'll probably take them in batches of two. So, who wants to kick it off?
Hi, can I just ask a...
Please speak up, just for the case of...
I hear what you say, and one's reassured, except the ironically named peace line. Mm-hmm. Is there still, in all its glory, symbolise? It does more than symbolise. It is keeping two communities apart. So, can you be really confident until that wall comes down?
Do I take
one more?
Yeah, go ahead.
Just a quick one. after World War II, there was the Marshall Plan, and after the signing of the peace agreement, there was the peace program there, which distributed by some estimates, about 2 million euro to a population of about 1.5 million, which actually makes it comparable to the Marshall Plan when you work out the economics. And so I'm struck by the fact that there's been no reference whatsoever to the peace funding in Northern Ireland and the possibility that it won't continue. So my question has to do with, what role did the peace program have to do with this stability that we've experienced, and what are the implications in terms of dissident activity and stability once it stops?
Okay, two very good, clear questions.
if I say the peace line's a good question. I mean, the peace lines, nobody wants to take them down. You know, it's extraordinary. There may be, maybe if somebody, maybe there's a redevelopment near your house and it was going to expose you to a housing estate nearby, maybe you would feel some uneasiness. I don't know. The reality is nobody wants the peace lines down. It is extraordinary, but it's a reality. They don't. No political party is going to stand up and lead a charge for bringing them down and integrating society here. The point Paul and I are both making is that with such a deep inherent division in the society, that is an instability that can produce enormous crises. On the peace funding, that you're right. We should have said more about that. And one of the factors there as well is, well, there's several factors at work at the moment. One at the moment that is causing huge headaches is the very rigorous accounting of that money. So, I mean, I know of at least one council which had to pay back £20,000 on a scheme simply because they didn't have the paperwork to justify every last penny that they were spending. So that creates headaches. The other side of it is that you could make an argument which says that the peace money does more harm than good, because we have a tradition of community groups. You basically frame your argument in this society around your application for money, you know, and therefore, you know, if the money is going to cross community and reconciliation and you want some money, then you frame every project you're involved in terms of you know, what potential it has for reconciliation.
And if you,
and the other thing is that you know, I mean, we saw, for instance, when massive rioting broke out, when the UVF attacked George Strand last year, and there was several nights of rioting, including shooting. The people who are then in the know, who then creep out and talk to the media and the politicians, explain, you know, that the real problem is lack of funding and lack of development, you know. And then you get meetings between politicians and community representatives. You know, when you hear the word community, there's money moving and there's guns being put back in cupboards. You know, that's what the word community means. It's a very, very toxic word in a society. So, so that, you know, so I don't know how the ending of peace funding or the ending of peace four will impact. Is it peace three? But there, whether there'll be a peace four, in other words. But I think that it's a question that we should be looking at. And I think that there are positive and negatives. I think there's danger that it causes more trouble than it saves.
Katie, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, just to pick on that point. Mm. I mean, you can see the negative side of the peace programme was the fact that it allowed politicians not to have responsibility for those very goals that Colin was talking about in relation to reconciliation and community development. And I think perhaps, if I might say, we've perhaps seen a reflection of that in the panel today, in that it's very easy for us to say from our middle-class perspectives, you know, we don't see a likelihood of violence returning as we saw it before. That's true. But violence can still exist within communities, and it is a very real threat, as is financial hardship in these communities. And I think we have to go beyond a situation where politicians are okay with that. And I think being able to talk about political disillusionment and peace lines, etc., and feel satisfied with that it says something about the nature of democracy and representation in this society today.
Well, I think you have to be careful when you discuss violence. I mean, violence is a very, very broad term, and I don't think anybody said that poverty wasn't going to produce violence. But I think the case that we were trying to make was that, and it wasn't a coherent case that we had agreed on or anything, but it came up in the discussion, was that it was very unlikely that the angst and difficulty arising from welfare cuts and so on would coalesce into a Republican case or an anti-constitutional case or a political argument that would threaten the peace process. Certainly it will create protests on the streets, the burning of shops, frustration in domestic environments and burning of cars and general mayhem in many ways. But, you know, that would become the engine that would drive a new Republican resurgence that would threaten the peace process is what I'm saying. That is very unlikely. That's not that there will be no violence at all because of poverty.
Yeah, just make a brief response to that then. You could say perhaps the legitimacy of the peace process itself is queried by the fact that violence on the streets is seen as a very contained problem for certain deprived communities, and maybe it won't make republicanism, mainstream republicanism, sort of draw back to a more divided kind of discourse that you were talking about before. But that's still not necessarily to say that it's not a problem or not a real threat to the peace, you know, especially long term. I'm talking about long term here, you know, it's the next 10 years or so.
Yeah, just briefly on that one, Eric. Like, Hume used to have this speech when I came to work with him in the mid-90s, I just stood down, to talk about the 13 peace walls in Belfast that screamed at us. And said they were indictment, they just roared at us. And this was a speech he used to deliver in the mid-80s. And it's ironic, there are more peace walls today, many more, many, many more than there were at the time of the ceasefire. So the peace walls are actually a product of the peace process. And you have to ask yourself why. Well, one of the reasons why is because the nature of violence changed, and we could spend all afternoon talking about the nature of violence changed and the characteristics of it. And that brings us to the point that Katie and Malachy were arguing about 5 or 6 years ago. If you tried to argue, as I did to my cost, that there was a direct connection between social inequality, in other words, poverty, and segregation, you'd have got your balls shot off. The Shinners and others on the opposite side of the fence would have gone for you like mad, saying, no, political inequality is the issue in the society. It's discriminatory. There is a separate relationship between poverty. But the truth of the matter is that the Belfast Interface Project produced a report only about 2 or 3 months ago where they show that the closer you get to a peace wall, the poorer the household becomes. That's mapped. It's beyond argument now. It's a set
of cause, which is effect.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which way around is the cause and effect?
Well, we could debate this all day. But, I mean, to the rational outsider, there's only one cause and effect, you would think. Yeah, the existence of the wall is an issue. But there are enough counter-arguments in this society to make that politically not a consensual position to be able to hold. Which brings us to the question of peace funding. And peace funding started off as a great lever to build capacity within communities. And I can reflect on the village area, South Belfast, where you're in just about inside my... No, you're not. You're just outside my constituency, one street away from my constituency at the moment. But over the road out the back here is Sandy Row, and then beyond that is the village, and they're in my constituency in South Belfast. And the women's movement, the women's centre in the village, the Windsor Women's Centre, is one of the pioneering capacity building projects within a working class loyalist community, funded out of peace monies and run down in the past 4 years because the peace monies have shifted from that type of work into post-conflict paramilitary keep the boys out of trouble type work. That's a product of our politics, okay, and that's something that the two larger parties need to address, because that's not the point of the peace monies. And I think that's why we see the creation of social investment funds and the budget, you know, there's 80 million for, you know, marginalised communities. I think it's an acknowledgement by Sinn Féin and the DUP that this, they've created expectations among certain communities that certain types of people will be funded. And you can draw your own conclusion as to why they've been funded. But you have to be very careful when you go there, because you can create a dependency culture. And that dependency culture, as Malachy, I think, rightly says, can manifest itself in anger in a way that would be entirely unacceptable in other parts of the world, yet is just taken for granted here. Have a bit of a riot in the hope that you'll get a bit of a financial return. And that's why reconciliation remains the big, unfaced up to challenge of our peace process. People just ignore it. They buy it off, they work around it, they build walls around it, but substantially reconciliation gets ignored.
Can I just say one very quick thing in response to that? That money, that investment, isn't in these communities, isn't translated into political capital, particularly in loyalist communities. So that disjunction between the representation,
yeah,
and that's a big problem.
Yeah, it is in Republican communities.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
Sir. Just one point about Bernadette Magaliski. A very shocking statement she made, not to Playboy, was that the provisional IRA were armed Hibernians, which always impressed me greatly that she has this understanding or significant belief. It was an ethnic dispute in many ways. Mm. But just two possible economic developments that could completely wreck this place. One is if Britain goes the way of Ireland, and we're not that far away in terms of debt and deficit. You know, that is not far from impossible scenario within the next 2-3 years.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, the money would really dry up here. And secondly, when the money, peace money and Atlantic philanthropy money dries up, Atlantic philanthropy gives more to Northern Ireland and employs more people than Bombardier or Shorts aircraft factory. When that money goes, you're going to have a huge residue of highly educated, highly motivated middle class people with no jobs and no prospects, and they could turn to amazing things.
Form a new political party.
Very, very right. Briefly, in the name of equality of esteem, about Bernadette's interview in Playboy, there is, of course, Trimble's famous pamphlet, not actually in Playboy, in which he says, how could an independent Ulster be financed? And he says, from Antrim Lignite will be the material result. So it's not, I think we ought to face up to the economic realism of both main traditions.
Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, just very briefly, when I was talking about the loony ideas that were in the ferment in the 1970, one of those loony ideas was the unionist perception that they were under siege, And I think I was very pleased to hear Peter acknowledge that to some extent. But I mean, the Unionists believed what only the IRA believed as well, which was that the IRA could produce a united Ireland. And for a Unionist to respond to that as if it was a plausible project made things much, much worse than they needed to be.
There is a tendency that within some people within Unionism, there is almost a sort of self-defeating prophecy at times on it.
Yeah.
And again, this maybe comes down to the issue I talked about in terms of confidence and that side of things.
Yeah.
Now, I think sometimes that has been a degree of rational basis on it. I mean, you know, I think, for example, mentioning about the South and the fact the South would run away from coming anywhere near us. Mm. Having said that, if you were a Unionist, particularly in the 70s and 80s, particularly living in a border area, where you saw, for example, lack of extradition, you saw a situation in which a terrorist campaign was carried out and people were effectively able to go back and forth across the border.
Yeah.
For you to come to maybe what was the wrong conclusion, that there was, you know, a greater scheme of things in the Republic of Ireland than was the case, was not an entirely irrational conclusion. It was not that. It might have been the wrong conclusion, but it wasn't entirely irrational on that basis.
Yeah. But it was a dangerous one in that it encouraged people to arm in defence of the Union when the Union was under no threat, whatever.
No, I think that's true. I mean, there is still resonances of that we see today because... Yeah. Sometimes, you know, I come across Unionists who, you know, and particularly probably of an older generation, that whenever you're talking to them and they come into the office or whatever, sometimes are all too readily to accept absolutely 100% what, you know, Gerry Adams or Martin McGuinness or, you know, someone, they will accept almost something coming from republicanism as gospel that should be swallowed whole. And it's an odd thing, you know, they'll say, oh, but... You know, Martin McGuinness said there'd be a border poll in 2016. There's going to be one. Well, no, actually, that's not. And you know, there is at least a strand within Unionism that at time. And to be fair, and it may go beyond simply Unionism. It's outside of it. That almost will take what seems to be the voice of your political opponent and swallow it absolutely whole, and then have an utter degree of disbelief from anything that is said within Unionism.
Yeah.
And, you know, that there is still a resonance there.
Yeah.
And maybe that's a degree of outworking of that sense of lack of confidence at times in opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, well, sorry, the other thing I just said, I mean, to some extent, Unionists feeling under siege, to some extent, the people who create that situation, if you have an armed violent campaign directed against your community, it's not entirely surprising that some people feel themselves to be under a sense of siege. So from that point of view, again, it's not.
Yeah.
It may be wrongly placed at times, but it's not utterly an irrational fear.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Is it too soon to have an opposition other than Jim Allister?
No, I think in terms of that, I mean, I think first of all, there's a couple of possibilities there. I think there is the opportunity for the Ulster Unionists and the SDLP now. I think the SDLP have a particular view on things because of, I think, probably out of all the parties, and hopefully Conal takes it as a compliment, have an almost sort of zealous belief in the agreement as the be-all and end-all. And so consequently, maybe, I expect Conal maybe in a broader sense more open to change, but I think his party, maybe, and obviously to some extent the Ulster Unionists, probably had a degree of opportunity to go down that route at the weekend and seem to have moved away from it. I would like to see, in the broader sense, reformist structures in opposition. The one thing, though, because Jim Allister will quite often say this and others will say it as well, if there's going to be change, and I think from a Unionist perspective, I think Unionists are willing to see adaptation and movement in terms of change, the only way, from a practical point of view, that's going to happen is if the political representatives of both Unionism and Nationalism buy into it. And that's why, for example, whenever Jim Allister will say, well, no, we should just demand this of the government and that type of thing, the reality is that one of the things we've learnt and, you know, A, structures of government need buy-in of both communities. And secondly, no government, even the most partisan pro-unionist government you could find at Westminster, is not going to come in and impose something above the heads of either the unionist or the nationalist community in that sense. I mean, that's where that has shifted. Might have been 25 years ago or longer ago, you know, I'd say as a unionist at times, the government would come and impose something on my head. But, you know, and so therefore, if there's going to be changes to the structures, we do need sensible debates on it. But we've also actually got to reach a situation that, in terms of where people are saying, no, this is the position to stick to on it, that can only be by way of a degree of persuasion, I think, in that regard.
If it only were as easy as sort of saying we have an opposition, everything's fixed. I mean, the system of government we have is not an adversarial system. It's not designed to be. It wasn't modelled on any other adversarial system. It was modelled, those of us who were knocking about the talks will remember, on a kind of a hodgepodge of the European Parliament and Congress and the States, with a lot of consociationism thrown in to reflect the divided nature of a society. So the theory is the tension should lie in the committees. The question is, why don't we get tension out of the committees? And that may be as a result of just the mathematics inside the Assembly at the moment. It may be because of our political culture. So an equally legitimate question to ask is the politics broken rather than the system? Are we incapable of having a type of politics that can work, the system we have? Is our politics too adversarial and therefore incapable of working a system that is that requires a consensual approach to be successful? I think there are things we should and must do in the short term, though. For example, Peter is the chief whip of the DUP, and first and deputy first ramp in twice a month for half an hour of questions. And if you were to tally up the number of questions and supplementaries that get asked of the first or deputy first from either Sinn Féin or the DUP, out of the block that get asked in that half hour period, you find the majority of questions that the first or deputy first minister asked are actually softballs. Now, that doesn't require a big revolution in the system. It just requires someone to be willing to take an occasional difficult question. Because of the way we do questions...
Somebody with hard balls.
I thought you'd use shot off.
I said you would.
All right, okay. It's conditional.
But I'm very protective of mine, as you know. And they'll certainly not be fired in anger. If you allow the current parliamentary structure to continue with current modalities, which are that we apply to Hunt even for the rotation of questions, it's impossible to create
strictly,
any sense.
Strictly speaking, again, without getting... I probably, from a panel, and without insulting anybody, probably there's a number of anoraks in this room in that regard. question time doesn't actually reflect the Hunt. It reflects the balance of individuals within and parties within the Assembly in that regard. And from that point of view, there is no doubt that all ministers, I mean, generally speaking, will get reasonably soft questions from their own parties in that regard.
But it does create a great inequality, because if you're a Sinn Féin or DUP minister, you're guaranteed a home run.
No, I'd say that on two grounds. A DUP minister will probably get fairly soft time from DUP members. A Sinn Féin will be not in a vice versa type situation, but that is true of any party. I mean, if you look at Westminster, you look at the Doyle, are you really going to get heavy forensic questioning of anybody towards their own party? And I think that is the nature of parliamentary politics in that regard. And I have to say, Conal, with the greatest degree of respect on it, and I appreciate, obviously, you've been kicking around for a great bit as well, whenever you had an Ulster Unionist minister or an SDLP minister or whatever, you know, they were not getting grilled by members of their own party, whether they're first or deputy first. And that is the nature to that extent of politics. But, and it's going to...
But if you have a joint office, as we do, and you ramp in twice a month for questions, and it's going to be the fourth supplementary before a difficult one gets there...
Well, no,
I don't accept
that as analysis, because the reality is, if you've got the Deputy First Minister, there will not be soft supplementaries come through the EP. Similarly...
That's only if you let Gregory in and you do your best.
Well, with the greatest degree of respect on it, nobody from outside of their own party is going to get a soft supplementary. The reality is going to be, I suspect, of almost any party, nobody's going to go out to embarrass a minister of their own party, but it doesn't cut on a Sinn Féin DUP axis any more than I'm sure it cut whenever it was an Ulster Unionist SDLP axis a number of years ago.
Well, anyway, we'll go past the softballs and hardballs. I'd like to thank our speakers and thank you for coming out. Thanks very much. Yeah.